I think Slope of Enlightenment is the beer that you get after you do yoga in the brewery at 11 in the morning.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. When your downward dog is over, you bet. Yep.
There's chamomile in it. Yes.
Yeah. It's chamomile and St. John's wort. You're nicely balanced.
Wow. I'm glad we're already recording this stuff, even though we haven't started yet. Because that's where maybe we have started yet. This is what happens. So this is what has happened the last several times, it seems, that we've had guests. We start talking and then we go, we never introduced this. Do people know who they're talking to?
Well, that's your problem, Greg.
That's my problem.
Cut it. Yes,
I do. Mm-hmm. So good morning. Good morning. Welcome to Hopnology.
thanks for having me, Greg and James. I appreciate it.
So this is Alexi is with us. Alexi has his own podcast, Heavy Hops, which is a mix of the beer industry and heavy metal, and it comes together extremely well. And it's an interestingly natural fit. So James has been on, Alexi has been on your show a couple of times, and we thought it'd be great to get you here as well. But first, we have to just tell all the listeners that yes, we are all caffeinated up. Everyone's holding their coffee.
Just started.
I personally have had one of those weeks where there's not enough coffee in, never mind in my house, but I think in the world for the week I've had. So, get your caffeine in.
I'm ramping into it this morning.
This is my favorite time of year for coffee. The folks at Dark Matter here in Chicago do a huge barrel bonanza where they do different cask and barrel treatments of beans and then roast off the alcohol. And so around Christmas, there's like 15 or 17 different SKUs of different like barrel treatments of coffee beans. And I just buy one of each. And so from January, well into March, I'm wired on some pretty exceptional stuff. So that's what I'm tuned into today. And I think that, you know, tying into what you were sort of mentioning about this, like this crossover, is that the creativity is just really, really sort of amazing in what you see people doing with different kinds of beverage. And I find these processes to be so similar with music too, and with musicians. I mean, ultimately, like, these are people that create, and they're people that talk about people that create and things that are involved in the people that create things. And so the actors are kind of the same in a lot of ways, whether it's in like the world of manufacturing, which is what we talk about with beverage, or agriculture, which is a focus of this show, or within the music industry, there's a lot of similarities. And so I find that these the correlations that you mentioned are like, they really do come out naturally. I was really like pleasantly surprised within doing the first like 15 episodes that, wow, this is all actually, you can have a really similar conversation with totally different people. And I'm glad that that comes through, because to me, that's a really, really important thing about the show, is for people to see similarities between things that may appear to be very different, or may appear to be more sort of conducive or attractive to certain people. Like, to be able to just kind of suggest the correlations is part of the fun part to me.
Mm-hmm. And the creativity part of it, absolutely. There's so much correlation there. And of course, you can take that to another level. I'm going to, you know, as is a staple of our show, I'm going to go negative Nancy here, or Captain Bringdown, as James calls it. You've also got the side of it that we always talk about with brewers, where they eschew their creativity for, how am I going to bring people in and make the money? And of course, you know, there's plenty of that in the music industry as well. There's who's going to be formulaic and just try and cash in a buck, versus who's sticking to their creativity bones and going along that route. So, yeah,
it's hard to like have those conversations with people where,
when they're on your show,
you go into it, have a feeling. Yeah. You have a feeling. You're like, I know like your last couple of albums, the optics were super commercial and they were very different from what I remember and what I was attached to, you know, 10 years ago. Or, you know, if we're talking about like Bev, oh, now you're fully engaged in FMBs, or you're like making a hazy milkshake monstrosities. Whereas you started as a lager thing. It's weird. Like, you want to give people an opportunity to like explore what they're doing and to have that sort of learning curve. But it's also a little frustrating when you're an enthusiast and you see the faults are pretty clear in that. And so what I've done is actually put two different guests back to back week to week who have very opposing views and who would probably get into a fist fight in person. And I let the listener sort of see all of that play out.
That's why he doesn't have me on anymore. Because he's afraid of the fisticuffs. No.
I think, yeah, we'll have James on and we'll have someone from Boston Beer talking about FMBs.
Yeah, right.
But it's, I mean, at the same time, you know, I think we're all here to, because we appreciate people that like make technically good stuff and that are true in a certain sense to their instincts. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can say that about people that make FMBs as well. In some case, it's really the market, less so the maker, that is responsible for creating a lot of the optics that we take issue with.
Yeah, I think that I love the concept of the maker concept, whether it's music or beverages or venues and events and experiences. And I think that really does resonate with me. I have, obviously, you know, I'm quite interested in how things work, whether that be molecules and chemistry or, you know, farm agricultural things, or how people think, how they, and you've probably heard this in some of our episodes, you know, how do trends happen, right? How does this concept of third space occur? How does a brewer or a maker creator go from thought leader to follower and be okay with that? And is that a conscious decision? So, I mean, I like the concept too of in our space where we look at beer as sort of the central axis, and around that, all of the parts of our, frankly, our daily lives and the way we are influence that central pivot point. You know, it's very, very cool. And we can go, as we do, down the rabbit hole, you know, numerous times over the past few years, talking about, you know, confirmation bias and
the slope of enlightenment.
Anything we might find, you know, of reading some sort of corporate psychology rag, and I'm like, oh, we can use this in the next episode. Let's talk about this and yeah, trends and 8 pounds of hops per barrel, which.
And it always ends with get those kids off my lawn.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, we pretty much spiral into old man syndrome there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, as participants in the industry and fans of the industry and fans of the product, both the hop product and the beer product, there's this passion about it. And you clearly have that on the beer side as well as on the music side. And so you're aware, I'm a musician. I don't know if it's come up, but I am not in the heavy metal space. I'm a jazz and classical musician. James makes a face at me. But I absolutely see that link of the creativity and doing things for passion and trying to put something out there that you love and want to share with others. It's less about, I want you to love me because I made this. And it should be more about, I want you to love this too, so we can share the experience. That to me is that common thread between the music and brewing and making in general, to James's point.
Yeah, I think precisely it's all part of this big pot. And at a certain point, if you as a maker may end up with an opportunity to try your hand in another part, someone may come up to you and say, hey, let's do business. I love this thing that you do. We can start a business around making beer. I don't know if that happens anymore, but I think that there's sometimes it takes like an external opportunity for you to take that jump from being someone who's an at-home musician or who is a rehearsal space musician to then, you know, engaging with the outside world with your art. And if you're a brewer, that's similar path from being like a home brewer to being a commercial brewer. You know, there's the investment and all of the good and bad that comes with that, and how you sort of, how heuristics come into a lot of the decision making thereafter, is what makes those things really different. And I think that it's exactly where all these sort of biases that you were alluding to earlier, I mean, they are everywhere in how we see things as well from our vantage point, and for producers too, everyone falls victim of them in some way. And so it's tough to watch and easy to see from the sideline, but they're universal, because at least in the West, just because everyone's going to fall victim of them at some point, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. Absolutely.
I'm curious. I want to maybe go back to a comment I made a minute ago about trends. And I'm really very curious on your perspective of where you've seen creativity shift to trend following from thought leader, and why you think that happens. I mean, there's no one reason, right? But I'm just curious as to what your observations might be.
Yeah. As far as like fads and trends,
yeah,
I think,
yeah. Let's talk about fad first, as before mm-hmm. fad becomes a trend, before it becomes a thing. Mm-hmm. You know, where do you see that occurring? How does that evolution spark, you know?
Yeah. So I think if I was listening to one of your episodes and you were talking about seltzers and trends and fads. And I think that if you think of seltzer as that's defined, which is really in like a flavored malt beverage, those are not new by any stretch of the imagination. And Truly's been, I think it may have been under a different name, but Boston Beer first tried to launch it in 2016. So it's not as though it came out of the woodwork necessarily. Those companies spend a lot of time perfecting those products. And so stuff like that is never going to go away. It's almost like beyond a trend, but how something like seltzer becomes from like a fad into a trend is it's internal and external forces within the specific world of beer. So the external forces, I would say, would be things like all of the health conscious trends. I think there was some defection from beer as a result of where beer was going and where people wanted to begin to adopt and try new things, because they've had all the beer that they were going to have, or maybe it was too overwhelming to see all these different breweries pop up. There was almost too much choice. And those products that are like seltzers are marketed really, really well, and they're marketed in a very smart way to people. And so the adoption was a pretty easy choice for a lot of people, I think. And so those would be, it's cheesy to say internal and external forces, but I really think that those are the two buckets that you want to look at to begin with when you're assessing like what is going to be a short-term, non-permanent trial on the part of a company to something that's going to be sustaining and that is going to be then adopted on a trial basis by breweries, because they're seeing small breweries, because they're seeing large beverage companies be very successful with it. It's not always very common when you see things go from bottom up. I found that things really kind of become top down when it comes to products like in the flavored malt beverage, just because those huge companies have the scale and capacity and technical abilities to do that stuff really well. And it's you're not going to make money as a small producer packaging that and selling it. It's something that's a great enticement for people on premise. And that's really like where I think people will be successful with that going forward on the small scale. And the big people are always going to dominate it and beat it to death, as we've seen this year.
Yeah.
Do you see similar mechanisms at work in the music space? You know, when you talk about internal and external forces and what prompts people to change, you know, to, I hesitate to call it evolve sometimes because I guess that's a matter of perspective.
Assuming evolution is always in an upward direction. Yeah.
Some negative mutations occurring here. But you know, when we're talking about creativity and saying, you know, I was attached to you because of the music you made before, because of X, Y, and Z, and now I see maybe you're moving more towards a, let's call it mainstream or centralized, or I don't know what how you would describe it in the music world, but do you see similar mechanisms at play?
I think people behave remarkably consistently when it comes to things that they consume. And so they may view beverage and beer, or excuse me, beverage and like music much in the same way. And their habits of adoption may be really similar. Craft beer or small scale produced beer and heavy music have pretty strong adopters and a lot of people that stick with it for a very long time. And so the habits of people that have been in it for a long time stay pretty static. And then there's adopters that kind of come in and out of it. And I think that if you look at jazz would be another sort of interesting parallel with this, is that there's going to be an artist that breaks at some point from the underground or the enthusiasts see and give exposure to that particular type of expression of music in some way. And the people that have been with it for a long time have trouble with that idea in some way because they feel a sense of ownership of it. And so I think that the dynamics are remarkably similar, actually.
And on the music side, it usually involves, a song being placed in a Disney movie for that to happen, unfortunately.
That's what it seems like, right?
That's how crossover happens, is you get it in front of that mass market. But that's what, that's what your comment there makes me think of, are crossover artists. And to your point, the stalwarts and the purists in that industry who've been doing it forever tend to get a little upset when that happens because it didn't happen for them necessarily. And well, that's not real jazz. That's not
That's a
real
good statement. I
country.
like that. I
You
like
know?
that. That's a that's You're a therapist today. I like that. That's good.
This doesn't usually happen, so don't get used to
Oh yeah. That's my I had my one good comment. I'm gonna be quiet for the rest of the episode now.
it. But the personal the but and I'm sorry to interrupt you, but like the personalization that you sort of alluded to there is a really, really important part of the feeling that people struggle with when they see something that they feel as though was theirs, go off into like a more rosy sunset.
Sort of like Bell's Brewery saying, oh, they're a sellout because, you know, Larry Bell sold and now they're going to expand to four or five more states and blah, blah, blah. And the people that held Bell's really closely to their heart feel like it's a part of them and they have identity with it. And now it's turning into something else and they're not comfortable with that. When I look at it and I say, he's a business owner,
Yeah, he
the whole
won.
idea around it. Yeah, he won business. Congratulations, Larry. Well done.
He got to the top of the
Exactly.
mountain, planted the flag, and went, yay me. Nothing wrong with that.
Nope.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing is that sometimes the enthusiasts and consumers have a hard time seeing some of those things that a business owner has to go through, or the challenges that they face in pursuing what their goals are. And the enthusiasts that we were sort of talking about also don't really see that those goals may change for those business owners based on circumstances that are evolving. So it's this thing where people kind of need to be flexible and as consumers and understand that things change, but it's hard to do that when it's something that you've invested money in by, you know, going to shows and buying albums or going on a vacation and visiting the Bell's Brewery or whatever, wherever it may have been, like when you throw down in that way, like you feel really personally invested in what happens there and you build personal relationships with the, you meet staff, you meet people. Like it was, they did a great job if you left feeling that way in making you feel included in what they do. And so that's going to be a part of the fallout for people. But in the case of someone like Larry Bell, I mean, he really did want to have this to be a family business in some way over time. And I don't remember when it was evident that it wasn't going to work out with Laura taking over the company. You know, he had to, he had to make his way out. And frankly, he was, you know, pretty, he held on for a long time compared to his contemporaries.
Yes, very much so. Absolutely.
But it's so if we think of like a Bell's or New Belgium in the way of like a small commercial band growing and then signing to a big label, I think that there's as many, this is highly anecdotal, but there is a good number of Bell's out there in the equivalent of like the heavy music world where they've received some commercial success and they've refined some things that they do, but generally the thrust of what they do is relatively similar. They just now have all of these marketing tentacles and sales tentacles of a large company and globalization to aid in sharing and in sharing what they do. And those artists have had much better longevity than those that crash and burn.
Sure. Well, you know, right off the top of my head, U2 comes to mind. Pre and post Joshua Tree, U2. There are purists who will say nothing since then was ever the same, that this is not the U2 for them. And as a, you know, not as a U2 fanatic, but there's a lot of similarity between what they always did and what they do now, but there's no question they've gone more mainstream to some degree, not intentionally, but it's happened. And look how many more people it's brought their music to, their old music as well as their new. REM went through the same thing.
Yeah, like it's this thing where now we can share this thing that we had such a great experience with other people. Mm-hmm. And that's great for the artist. And hopefully that's good for the culture that sort of drew us into that music in some way.
Yeah. And, you know, I guess it can be somewhat different when you're talking about a physical product versus music. I mean, you're still making your music and you can continue making your music the way you made it. Maybe you can, but when a brewery expands to the point where things become unrecognizable, and I'm thinking of a couple of years ago with Ballast Point, where they were really, really popular and really, really small. And then they were purchased and spread out across the country and literally and figuratively diluted to the point where people didn't like the product anymore, people didn't like the culture anymore. And it's been, if I'm not mistaken, it's since been purchased again by someone else and kind of shrunk back into what it used to be. But I don't know if that's helped it recoup. But we did an episode about them maybe a year or so ago when all that happened. And it just went to show that sometimes having access to that expansion is the wrong thing for a brand. And I think they lost that personalization and that, as you mentioned before, Alexi, that connection that exists.
It's hard to scale that connection in some way when it's a person-to-person sort of interaction. And we can definitely talk about, you know, ways that businesses can do that in some way that are scalable. But I mean, the case of Ballast Point is pretty exceptional, I think, in terms of who bought them, what their experience was, as far as Constellation's goals were, and the amount of money that was spent, who bought them thereafter, and what's kind of become. That whole story is really sort of the epitome of the glut of what was happening with the mergers and acquisitions within beer. I think a lot of them have been, generally speaking, like a little bit different just because the parent companies are all a little bit different in some way. And then depending on when those occurred within the larger sort of thrust of the contemporary history of craft beer, it's you know, the experience for Goose was really different than the experience for, you know, 10th and Blake, or there was that brewery in North Carolina that does the sour beers that was purchased by AB. I'm blanking on them now, but not Funk Factory. That's up by you, James.
Yeah,
but in any event, like, they're all a little bit different in some way, but yeah, the Ballast Point one was all sorts of extreme in every way. And you're absolutely right. What was sexy about that brand was totally lost. And it's really kind of sad to see how all of that's playing out now for that. And the same with like Green Flash and Alpine too. I got an email that was, you know, saying that you could contract brew your beers at Green Flash. And I mean, that was a brewery for me that was like really important in introducing me to West Coast IPAs and to a certain type of beer that we didn't have access to. And it was pretty sad to see the downward trajectory. And that's people making business decisions as well, right? And it didn't end up being so great for them.
Cool. Greg, do you want to pivot to you had a comment when we first started. I'm curious to talk about event planning and what we know about events, specifically around beer events, but because I think, Alexa, you said there's plenty of crappy ones, right? What makes a good beer event, and how does that change during COVID?
And just to tee this up for the listeners as well, I mean, Alexi, one of your other ventures is Scorched Tundra, which is a music festival that you've been running for a very long time, a heavy metal music festival. And so you are no stranger to event planning. So now you're working with the Brewers Association and helping with event planning. So to James's point, things are different now. People are, they're coming out more than they used to, but we've had some hiccups in folks' willingness to get out and be around each other.
Yeah, event planning is really, really important for on-premise business. I mean, obviously, a lot of that was lost during the pandemic, and businesses are picking up the pieces and trying to figure out how can we get people out again? How can we create these sorts of experiences that we were sort of alluding to earlier that can be really special for people and that can attach them to a brand in some way, or can just make them feel like they spent their money well. And event planning and how it pertains to on-premise is really like a building block process, but it all really starts with having the fundamentals down as a establishment in the first place. And that is really revolving around being transparent, clear, and concise within your own organization, and then being that way with the customers too. So that means not having situations where your listings are incorrect and where public information is available that is not that's within your control, but that's incorrect. That is really like fundamentally the start. And then from there, you build out the online communication, because that's really how you're going to get people to be aware of what's happening in your place, and really sort of like understanding who you are, which is hard as a business owner, ironically, and understanding how people see you and how your neighborhood sees you. And at the same time, finding a way to sort of tread that path. So if you have a specific sort of niche that you follow as a brewery, you know, leaning into that in some way, but also being a good neighbor to everyone around you is really important, because their audience is your audience too. I think there's a lot you can get into about how you communicate and how marketing can work. I think the thing that I sort of stress the most to to mentees when we're working together is that you really have to be on top of your internal communication and then your external communication with your neighborhood. And you have to see yourself as part of a fabric, whether your fabric is your neighborhood or whether it's an online community of like-minded businesses, knowing who your audience is and then finding those people, through, you know, whether it's, you know, targeting or whether it's through, you know, some type of like, in-person communication, now that things are sort of, shifting from lockdowns into a little more leniency in terms of with Omicron, I think that those things are still going to be important because as people come back and gain their confidence of being in public and being in public spaces, having clear expectations of what they're going to find is really, really important so that they are not surprised. We know breweries can be very safe, clean places for people. They're certainly clean, hopefully. And it's important to take that similar sort of mentality to, you know, what you're sharing with people and, you know, treating your front of house the same way.
Do you think that there's a fundamental change that needs to happen as people think about their event planning in what the new normal is compared to what it was before? Because the expectation in maybe the attendee's mind is everything's back to normal, or is it? You know what I mean? Are they coming at it saying, well, I'm going to go to this because I want to experience it, but I know that it's not going to be the same way that it was. Do they want it to be? So, I mean, there's this, I would find some trepidation in saying, okay, we're going to get back and we're going to do this. We know we need to pivot a little bit, but what does that actually mean? And what is that expectation people have set in their minds about, you know, going back to their same old beer festival or going back to their favorite music venue that now suddenly is not the same as it was before because of things?
Yeah. You know, the mentees that I've worked with have all said that it feels very, very different putting on events now than they were before. And I agree in terms of the events that I've done as well. It is very different in terms of what people, for the reasons you listed, what people are sort of expecting and how they're interacting. And you really have to consider that from within how deliberate you are with what you organize. I think doing weekly events and doing events like trivia are actually like really, really good ideas now. These were things that in before times breweries thought, okay, we are this thing, this is what we do. They viewed it with a very sort of strict mentality. And I think that it's important to communicate the things that you feel about your business, but to be flexible with how you're communicating that and to being open to ideas and to be open to try things, because doing a trivia night costs like $50 to execute. It's not like a lot of money. And if you're a brewery that say, generates like $1,000 in rings in an evening, that's not a huge investment to make in an opportunity that could draw in a lot of people with those 15, regular events.
1500 if Greg shows up that night.
Yes. He brings his friends and his growlers, right?
Yeah, exactly. Trivia night.
Yep. And they know that he's not going to win, so they're not going to lose money on giving him growlers.
We've been coming in at consistent number two lately, very often.
Do you go to trivia every week though, Greg?
I do. So I have a group of folks, and there's some that come and go, but there's a few of us that are staples. We go every week to trivia, but I will tell you, it's interesting. My group, we sit outside. There's a tent out back. They have an air heater pumped in. There's the propane, you know, little umbrella things. And we sit outside when it's 15, 20 degrees outside, mostly because of me, because I look at them and go, I'm only staying outside. You guys can go in if you want to. And it's packed inside and we are alone outside and we have so much fun being outside, but we get there and say, hey, can you turn on the heat lamps? Oh yeah, sure. We'll turn on the heat lamps. Would they do that for just anyone? I don't know. They know me better than they should, I'll say, for my own health and safety, but they have pivoted to allow that. I would imagine if we weren't still, you know, mid to late COVID, they might just have the tent down for the winter and it just wouldn't be an option at this point in the year. But they still have that out there. Now, I went yesterday, the tent broke in the ice that we had here in the Northeast. So there was one group sitting outside around a little fire pit, but it was also like 10 degrees last night. So folks were packed on the inside, but they still had an option. They're still trying to allow folks that difference.
Yeah. And so was trivia something you did before in 2019?
No. Yes, I'd say it was. But only as an ancillary thing. It happened mm-hmm. to be the night we could all meet and there was trivia there. The first couple of times we all started meeting on that night, trivia was an annoyance. And then we came to realize we knew a lot of those answers they were talking about. So why didn't we get a sheet? And then it became a reason to go.
So this is about building the third space again for people. Mm-hmm. And so everyone's at home, not everyone is at home, but a lot of people are working from home full time or are, a couple days in, a couple days out. And so that third space is really, really important now that we're getting into, 2 years of this type of shift in our behavior. And so there's an opportunity there when those third spaces were lost for people to build new habits. And so I think that's why those weekly events are actually really, really great, because it gives people something that they can count on a weekly basis to do. It gives them a social engagement as well. And it's an opportunity where you have a captive audience every week to wow them or to at least show them something, something fun, and to have them tell other people and engage with other people. And so I think that you don't really even have to be the most creative. You don't have to come up with a new game of your own. You can do something like trivia and you just have to try things a little bit instead of just sticking to what you did before and having a hard line view of, no, this is what we do. This is what we did. This is what we're going to do. That's a failing mentality in some ways in the new era, I think.
Interesting. Yeah. And I know to your point about having these weekly events, I know for me as a customer, as a target of those, and you're right. I mean, I work at home now. I'm in front of that same screen in that same room for hours and hours and hours. And James, I've said this to you. I've said it to my trivia crew. Getting out of the house and doing that once a week, and especially getting some fresh air, even though it's freezing outside, it is very important to me. It's important to get out of here and take a breath and have a beer and, you know, show my command of John Cusack movies and all those important things that we need to answer on the trivia list. It's necessary from a psychological perspective.
Yeah. And I think that the daytime is really where the new opportunity is. I know you talked about the untapped data on this show, and I listened to Michael Roper, who owns a famous beer bar here in Chicago called Hopleaf. I've listened to a few of his recent interviews, and he was talking quite a bit about how he's seen a massive shift in the business from being evening time to a lot of like lunch and daytime. And so there's a lot of opportunity there, not just for the events, but also for new styles of beer and for lack of a better term, innovation or experimentation. Is that, I mean, this is behavior that's demonstrated that the consumers are offering you a trial opportunity with.
Do you think there's any Do you have you noticed anything where you're like, oh my Lord, that's a totally missed opportunity, right? It's like, why are people not taking advantage of this?
Yeah, I mean, I think in the end, I see anyone that is saying no, falls in that. Like, if you're a business that says, no, I don't want to do this type of event, I don't want to try something, that's where the failure is in not trying and not being sort of curious about your audience. I'm not saying that Sean Hill needs to have trivia up in Vermont, but I think I've seen a lot of breweries in Chicago who before the pandemic would have never imagined having those types of events because business was steady and was regular, but because of the disruption, they needed to, and how everything changed about how they sold beer, you know, they had to make an adaptation. So I think the failure is standing still.
Yeah, I don't know, Greg. I don't know if there's trivia in the future of the Dark Corner Bar.
Probably not for the Dark Corner Bar, but I do have to say that failure is standing still is today's t-shirt.
That's a t-shirt, yes.
Line. That's t-shirt, that's a line.
Totally t-shirt line. I think it's also the name of an album.
It should be. It should be. So Lexi, very important personal question for me. How do I get dogs and children out of my brewery?
Here.
Yeah, that flies in the face of what we were just talking about, right?
Yeah, really, like I said, the dark corner bar, the future for the dark corner bar is not looking good.
There might be a fish tank with a black light. That's the extent of the animals allowed in the dark corner bar.
Yeah, I think at a certain point, I like this dark corner bar idea because we've actually lost a lot of those in Chicago. And I think that they were an important sort of part of the consumer culture around AlkBev in Chicago. And I think that maybe that's a great place for people who don't want to be in brightly lit new wooded tap rooms where their family and animal inclusive. I've found that also breweries have become sort of more aware of who the people are that are bringing the animals, because they're pretty consistent. Like, it's that person brings their dog every Tuesday. Like, it's, there's not a ton of surprises outside of the weekend. And Greg, I'm going to take an estimate that you're not like a Friday night go out to the brew pub type of person.
Normally I'm more of a weeknighter, although I was there last night for a little bit. I tend to use the brewery as I got to drop my daughter off. I've got 2 hours to kill. I live 5 minutes away, so I could go home, but the brewery's also right there, so I might as well just wait for her nearby. So I was there last night next to a couple who had their dog for 2 weeks, and this was the first time they were bringing her out, and she was my size.
There's some things you can't change about people, nope. But I do think that I'm Captain Let Me Down now, I guess, but yeah. In some respects, I think that this stuff is good because businesses that are on premise or that are third spaces should reflect the population in general. If these businesses are going to succeed, they need to be welcoming to people. And so it's going to be just sort of a part of reality, unfortunately, Greg. I think that it sucks, but if I had like a small child and I needed a beer because I've been stuck with a small child in, it would be great to be able to take that kid out. And, you know, Greg, you've had a kid too. And so I think you understand what that's like.
Yeah. Yeah. I have my own kids. So it surprises people sometimes when I say, leave your kids at home. I ran into a friend last night who brought their kids with them who are the same age as my kids who are old enough to behave themselves. Mm-hmm. I will say, but yeah, that's my, you know, grumpy old man shtick, and it's not a shtick, it's real.
What I will say about like the crossover when it comes into like live music too is that I'm seeing a pretty substantial shift from longer shows of like 5, 6, 7 bands into much more consolidated two bands. You know, this is the entertainment, this is what you're getting. And, you know, some of that may be just because you're putting a lot of people into a small indoor space. And I think that some of that is part of what the entertainers are asking for in terms of their own COVID safety backstage. But I think that there's something there within the idea of doing something concise and doing it absolutely right is really what you can do to deliver on your promise to your customers, is doing exactly what you say you're going to do and offering, you know, the best entertainment value. And that's not necessarily quantity of things. That can really just be the best of the stated quality and of a more concise quality.
Do you, have you, that's interesting. And the thing that occurs to me is, do you see in that experience, do you see the number of instances increasing? So like you're, instead of having five or six or seven bands, you've got a couple. But do you see more instances of just a couple of band events popping up than you would have, like, you know, five or six or seven band instances?
Yeah. And that's because the people that book the shows, like the booking agents, are generally asking for more concise shows depending on the promoter. So like, James, you're sending Greg's band on tour, right? You're booking his band and I'm a venue.
Yeah.
So let's throw that out there.
Oh, yeah. Oh boy. Here we go.
Yep. And you want to book a show in Chicago and we come to an agreement that I'm going to host Greg's band. So in the past, you may have, James, have said, you know, Greg's band can draw 50 people. I really want to fluff them up so that, like, I can get them into bigger clubs. I don't want to play Alexi's show. I want to play a bigger venue next time. So, hey, Alexi, you need to add like four bands to this billing so that I can show Polestar that Greg actually drew 200 people, or whatever the case may be. And so that has changed a little bit because, one, we're just getting back into the swing of live music, but you don't want, James, in the good faith of Greg and his health, you don't want 100 people backstage if you're sending Greg on a 20-day tour. If he gets COVID, his shows are, you know, 3, 4, 5, 7 shows are canceled. And that means that Greg isn't getting paid. That means that people are, you know, looking for refunds. And for you, James, your agency isn't taking your 10 or 15% on those fees too. So, you know, it comes down to, it's a matter of like necessity at this point. But I think a lot of people now look back on the consumer side and see, wow, like I don't have time for all this stuff anymore because I was day drinking at the bar because now I go out during the day, or you know, I have to be up in the morning for like a work thing or whatever. Like all these sort of changing habits have done a lot to the nightlife side of things, which you guys have talked about with like that Untappd data review, which was really cool. Mm-hmm. And I think for nightlife, they've had to reconsider how much they expect people to spend when they're out, how long they expect to spend, when they're going to close, even in the context of no restrictions and places can be open to the extent of their license.
The new normal, right?
Yeah.
The new normal.
Right. New normal.
Yeah.
Which is actually but, makes me like, cringe. Well, it keeps on changing.
It's, it's the new normal, but it's personally, I mean, I would love to just go see 2-3 great acts and call it a night or go do another thing. I'm not going at 5 o'clock in the afternoon to a venue and I'm not going to hang out there for 5 hours necessarily. And I think it's unreasonable to expect that of people today too.
Yeah.
So that's another example of having to sort of change and shift based on where consumers are at and shifting how you used to do business into where things are now.
Wow. That's great. So Alexi, I had a game to play with you, and now I have a second one that I've come up with as we've been talking here. because it's something that you brought up before we started recording. I would like us to go through from one of our recent episodes, the Gartner Hype Cycle, and decide what genre band each one of the steps on the Gartner Hype Cycle is. I think okay. I think listeners would enjoy this.
This is awesome.
So the initial step on the Gartner Hype Cycle is technology trigger.
So I'm going to actually do this all within the context of heavy metal genres, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
So this first one clearly is a technical death metal band, probably from Germany or Sweden or some obscure Midwest location. 18-year-old drummer that plays blast beats at an insanely quick rate. Equally old guitar player who's great beyond their beyond belief. They put out two albums and go start startups 5 years later.
I think if, just like after every beer description, I say I would try that. I think all of these are going to be, I would give them a listen. I would actually give them a listen. Okay. So the next one, I love it, is the peak of inflated expectations.
Oh my, this is good. Peak of inflated expectations.
Mm-hmm.
So this is probably, it should be a power metal band based on, I want to incorporate a power metal band somewhere, and this is probably the best spot, just because of the sort of correlation to the lyrical content about like mountains and majesty and all this stuff. And this is probably their final album that they put out before their massive world tour.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
their first and last
before their Creed video breaks. Right. Yeah.
Exactly. Oh. Members go and join Nickelback. Right.
Exactly. Yeah. Yep.
Someone has to. All right. So the next one is the Trough of Disillusionment.
This is a doom band. Like 100%, I was actually thinking about like what band Trough of Disillusionment would be. Is this still the Trough of Despair too, or did I just make that up?
We've been calling it interchangeable, but yes
we have.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Trough of Disillusionment is definitely like a doom band from the UK. They probably toured with Conan like early and are from Liverpool. it's just, it sounds like the music you would enjoy if your brain were really, really battered and you just needed caveman style riffs.
Oh, great. Caveman style riffs. I like that.
That has to be added to the t-shirt list. Yeah. Speaking of which, I also added to the t-shirt list earlier when you were talking about James, setting me up with my, as my manager for my band, you said something along the lines of when you really want to fluff Greg up. And I said, that has to be on a t-shirt as well.
No, I don't need to think about that. No, anyway, no, continuing.
I think that should be on a t-shirt. So the next one is of course, the Slope of Enlightenment.
Slope of Enlightenment, I think is still the, it may even be a kombucha that you get. I think of this one more as like a beverage. It's like the beverage you get after doing goat yoga, and the goat yoga at the brewery. Maybe they were playing Trough of Disillusionment to like build you up into your enlightenment.
Awesome.
And then there's the last category. The last level is the plateau of productivity.
I think that's thrash metal because it's the most stagnant genre of music. So they're like a traditional Bay Area thrash metal band that basically steals riffs from Metallica's Kill 'Em All. that's that band. And they're still around. They still wear like leather vests on stage.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
They got like everyone has skirted eggshell style mullets. That's what I'm imagining for that one.
Nice.
Great. There is someone at Gartner listening to this who's either horrified or is trying to figure out a way to make this part of their next holiday party in some capacity. I love that. I love that. Okay, so the other game, we have a couple of games we play with our guests, and when we have brewers on, we give them fake names and say, what would you put in this beer? So I decided to go a little differently with you from a musical perspective. I've got a whole bunch of songs here, and I want to know what, because we haven't talked about what you like to drink. I want to know what you would drink while listening to each of these songs when you hear them on the radio. Now here's the kicker. You're listening to my radio. So these are not the songs
that you're typically... A lot of Kenny G.
Okay, I got to take that off the list now because Kenny G is on my list. Okay. We'll start easy, but we'll get into, these are things you'd hear driving in the car with me, and what beer would you want to have with you? So we'll
start... While you're driving the car, so I'm sitting in the front seat with like a roadie?
Pounding, yep.
Sure, yes. Okay, cool. Yes.
Let's do it that way. All right, into it. I got my visual set now.
Yeah, because then, and add to that visual, I'm probably singing along.
Got it. Okay, so I need something strong to endure your voice.
Then. Damn straight. Yep. So let's
start. You'd need one too if you heard me singing. So,
we'll start easy. I want to hold your hand. The Beatles. What would you want to drink with that?
Poison.
I'm imagining some type of.
John Lennon reference.
Remember when people were putting flowers in beer? Not that I would want to drink those beers necessarily, but that's what I imagine is when like Goza was something people were doing a decade ago, and that was like Saison. New and sexy. Exactly. I'm thinking something an adjunct, but more of like a floral uplifting sort of beer. Sub 6%.
Something floral. Sub 6%. Good luck finding that. Another one of the things we complain about a lot. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So how about Don't Worry, Be Happy?
This is like uplifting. You listen to uplifting music. I listen to depressing stuff, apparently.
Which is why I knew this would be a challenge.
Yeah, this is good. Don't Worry, Be Happy. Man. I would say a porter. Like, to me, that's a style of beer that makes me really happy. It's a style of beer that I find good balance with. I love the flavor profiles of it. It reminds me of things that I enjoy. A well-executed one reminds me of things that I enjoy eating. It reminds me of pleasant experiences with food and in life. And so that's what I would go with.
Everyone listening right now knows that I'm pulling the car over to join you with the porter.
Yeah. So this would probably be Founders Porter specifically.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Oh, I like that. Okay. Elvis, Little Heartbreak Hotel.
So, I mean, this is light lager territory for me, I would say. Maybe PBR, something of the time frame when there were like five breweries in the United States.
Okay, so we get to our destination. I pull us into the parking lot, and we're now at Lilith Fair. So, do you remember Lilith Fair?
Oh yes.
Oh yeah.
Yes.
So, some Indigo Girls, some Sarah McLachlan. What are we drinking there?
Tori Amos.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, at this point, after all this music, I'm probably going to want to damage myself. So I'll drink a kettle sour.
You better make it an imperial while you're at it.
A nice imperial 8%, 3.2 pH kettle sour. I really just, not only do I want my senses to be totally knocked out, I also want my teeth to eviscerate too. So just give me an enamel ripper.
Oh my. All right. And the last one, just to put a capper on it, because I don't know how you can get worse than the kettle sour, but let's see if you can try. We head home and I put on repeat for the entire ride, What's New Pussycat by Tom Jones.
Is there like a sidecar I can get into so that I'm not in this vehicle with you?
I hope you have your, just call Uber. Just pull over here. I'll be fine.
Yeah, give me an Uber. I'll sit next to that person's Grubhub order.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what? I think after all of these drinks that I've had so far, I'll probably want something I actually enjoy. And even though my enamel will be gone and my senses will be messed up, mm-hmm. I'd probably go with an Oud Goose.
Oh, well, that's been an interesting trip that we've had together. Certainly.
That was a lot of fun, actually. I've never I haven't really thought about pairing in that way, but there was talking about like on-premise events, like there was a whole trend of like pairing music with beer, and mm-hmm. This was probably like after the peak of enlightenment of the beer dinner times, you know, there was like pairing with music and
yep.
All that stuff. And, you know, that you kind of got my wheels turning a little bit. That could be a really cool thing too, in the sense of engaging with people. Mm-hmm. It's just like rethinking the sort of like pairing and rethinking. I tried to do this, I was working at a beer bar in Chicago called Local Option as the buyer, and I put together all their beer events for a long time and worked with their contract beers. And I wanted to do like a blind tasting thing, and the owner just like wasn't into it. And I still think that it would be a really cool idea, because I think that when you give people an opportunity to sort of like be wowed and discover, that's like sort of a point where like you can build a lot of loyalty, and taking away people's ability to see infers a lot of trust, obviously, but also there's a great opportunity to teach them something, or to at least let them think, because we eat and drink with our eyes so much.
Sure, sure. And we've talked quite a bit about sensory, and the Dark Corner Bar has a sensory corner, where a corner of the Dark Corner Bar where you can sit and do actual sensory work. And that's, quite honestly, you know, you talk about food pairings. A little bit of the problem I have with that is that that's not a teaching moment for folks that don't know what they're doing. That's a confounding moment where you've got all these other flavors going on and whatnot. And it's, once again, as you said, you get to learn on your own instead of being told what goes well together. We need more sensory out there, more ability for folks to try things.
Yeah. Yeah. James, from your perspective, I'm just kind of curious on this, because I mean, this is right in your wheelhouse. And I think we talked about this when you came on my show a while ago too, about like sensory but as far as like how it can be delivered to people.
It's all about, I like your comment about trust, because it is the, when you take away the cues that inform that create our expectations. I'm looking at that, and we talked about this a few episodes ago, Greg, about, you know, blonde stouts, white stouts, mm-hmm. right? Where your visual cue is telling you to expect one thing, and you put it in your mouth and you have sensory dysphoria, and suddenly the stout flavor and body that you love, you don't like anymore, or you find it discordant. That's a really interesting perspective. I love that concept of a blind tasting. I was also intrigued by the concept of a blind tasting in combination with exposure to music, and how that sort of stimuli would affect your palate perception. I've never read anything on that, but now I'm super curious.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of variables, right?
If you need to book Greg's band, just let me know, because we'll make sure we give you a good deal.
Included with the ticket is a little sensory corner experience too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I love it.
Yeah. There was something, James, you mentioned on the show that I've thought of as the Altweiss doctrine.
Oh,
and
Christ.
That is,
which one? Why are you giving things like that? Oh my God.
It was we were talking about non-traditional farming, and at the sort of end of the show, you said that you implored everyone to try their hand in agriculture.
Yep.
And I have a corollary to that in some way. And that is pretty simple. It's be thoughtful and be curious within that, because for a lot of people like myself, I shouldn't hold things that are sharp. I shouldn't hold things that make music. Like, that's just bad for society and dangerous. But there is a lot of opportunity to support people that are makers in a lot of ways. And if you have like sort of an impulse to be in that world, and you find that making music or being involved in the actual like hands-on process isn't really for you, there's actually like a pretty messed up cycle that happens to people where they feel very disenchanted and they end up leaving altogether and jumping into something different. And for things like what we do, whether it's within music or whether in beverage or agriculture, we don't want to lose really talented, thoughtful, creative people just because they have a bad experience in some way. So I think that staying curious and staying engaged and thoughtful are really important, because that's kind of why I came back into journalism. I started writing about music almost 20 years ago. That was my first entrance into music, and it ended up becoming this like whole other thing of organizing events and having a label. And I sort of put some of it behind me a while ago, and I found that I came back just because I was curious and I wanted to be engaged again. And, you know, I regret in some respects leaving some of that behind. And so I always, you know, I really encourage people just to sort of stick with it and to be imaginative about how you can support these people that are doing these things. Because as we know with what's happened in beer, and I see it with music too, you can't make stuff and then just like scream at a wall and expect it to sell. That's just not how things work. And you've talked about it on the show with like with farming too. Like, you're not going to sell your hops just because they grew. And so people need to be involved in all steps of that process. And for those that are curious, maybe they'll find, hey, like, I actually love buying stuff. Like, I'm a consumer of things. Maybe you can be a procurer somewhere. Maybe you love to smell these things. Maybe there's a route into science or into on-premise education that you can do. There's so much that people can do. So within the try your hand and just like get your hands dirty and do something, I think also the other thing is just like stick with it and actually like be curious and thoughtful and engaged, because there, if you like something, there is a space for you. You just may have to dig a little bit harder or find it in a non-obvious way, or it could be a matter of external forces opening a path for you that 5 years later is there.
Very well said. Very well said. Alexi, thank you for joining us. This has been great. I want to make sure everyone knows. So Heavy Hops is Alexi's podcast. Comes out weekly, I believe.
Yeah, every Thursday.
Every Thursday. So you got us on Mondays. You got Alexi on Thursdays. That's your week. Go for it, gang. Go find him. Give him a listen. And thank you again for joining us. This has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, this is a lot of fun. Thank you so much, Greg. Thank you, James.
I think the Altwise Doctrine is Trough of Disillusionment's second album.
Yes, it is. Oh, my God. That's good. Oh.